After the Gaylord, David, at about that point in the automobile span of time and mm-hmm. models and so forth, both custom and individual and mm-hmm. or separate manufacturers and so forth,
yes.
I was still involved heavily with Willys.
Yes.
And we were asked to come to Brazil when Edgar Kaiser has now purchased Kaiser Brazier Corporation, or Kaiser Motors, mm-hmm. as it was finally called. Mm-hmm. And then they were in Toledo. They moved from Willow Run. Now
yes.
they moved over and took the whole Toledo operation and began to build some cars there. We're coming up on...
They'd taken the old Willys plant.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And they finished assembling some of the cars there. Mm-hmm. And they put the Kaiser, the 51 Kaiser, which has now become the 55 or whatever it is, the last one we built here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 55 or something. Uh-huh. And sent it to Brazil, if you remember.
Yes.
Or to Argentina. And it was built down there called the Carabella. And it was built there for many years thereafter.
Do you remember that executive from Michigan?
George Harbert.
Was it?
It went down to run that, and
right.
he was killed down there,
yes.
unfortunately, in an
right.
Alfa Romeo.
That's right.
And they were building the Alfa and from Italy and the Kaiser Carabella. And George Harbert, who was a very close friend of mine, was an excellent
mm-hmm.
young the executive
yes.
from Kaiser,
mm-hmm.
part of that first group from California.
Mm-hmm.
And he was killed in an Alfa one night on a dark, rainy road or something, just
uh-huh.
crashed into the back of something. And
oh.
It took him right then and there.
Oh.
Now, at this point, we created the new Aero Willys.
Just tell us a bit about that.
The
Aero
Willys you saw in the... Did you look that car?
Yes.
Now, that car has only been about 100 miles.
That's
from brand new. It's never been... I drove it a little bit and put it in there.
Right.
Now that was taking the Willys early post-war car,
mm-hmm.
Which had been developed as a two-door coupe sort of a car and a
mm-hmm.
four-door, an extension of Barney's older car,
right.
but a new body and so forth. And it had gone up through 54 or thereabout.
Mm-hmm.
And we took that, the duplicate tooling was sent down there, and they were building the car down there as the Aero Willys. And so I was asked to take that car and try to facelift it and upgrade it
mm-hmm.
and to change it as much as possible, try to look like an all-new car but not spend, you know, $70 million
yeah.
to do it because they didn't have it.
Right.
So I think it was less than $6 million or something was spent. And we redid the whole front end. If you notice, the fenders
yes.
are new, the bonnet
mm-hmm.
is new, the
right.
lower front grille is all new.
Uh-huh.
I kept the windshield pillars, but straightened up all the pillars thereafter, and the C-pillar, put a whole new roof on it,
right.
cut the doors off, and put convertible-style windows in them instead of the old-fashioned reveals.
Mm-hmm.
Kept the rear deck and re-stretched out the rear pendant. In those days, we were trying to take a 104-inch wheelbase and make it look like 120. So it was the exact reverse of what they're trying to do now by
right.
stunting the big gas guzzler and make
right.
it into the small car without changing the wheelbase.
Mm-hmm.
So they chopped off all the fenders and brought everything into one envelope and thereby turning the whole process around. That's
right.
all economics and people's whims and whatever. So in doing that new Willys, and I built scale models of that, which are in the museum,
mm-hmm.
or in the show down there, I think you'll see it.
Right.
And I took the, flew the quarter size model down to Brazil, and they said, boy, this is it, let's go. We took pictures, which was the trick of the day, outside in front of a public building,
mm-hmm.
lay down in the grass, the cameraman did, and took the shot, looking up at it, you know, and looked in the finished print, just like a real automobile, full
mm-hmm.
size.
Mm-hmm.
And the management would say, well, where did you get that? How did you build it? You know, what, my God, did you spend $200,000 to build that thing? And then we say, no, that's this quarter size model, and took it out of a case. There it was, complete with every interior detail, seats in it that were real, instrument panels, little steering wheels, all the dials, and
mm-hmm.
the whole thing was done in there.
Mm.
So from that, they okayed it, and we went ahead and built a full-size prototype down there. And I kept a regular studio down there.
In Toledo?
Yeah, no, in Brazil.
Oh, of course.
San Paulo.
Yes, right.
San Paulo. We're down in Brazil.
Yes.
And I put some American and some of the Brazilians in there as people to carry on.
Sure.
And I'd go back and forth
mm-hmm.
every month or thereabouts to see how it was going up to the full size and then in production and on we went.
Mm-hmm.
So Edgar, or Sherwood Egbert enters the picture now.
Where'd he come from?
And to show you how things turn and go around and start over again, Sherwood Egbert was the vice president of McCulloch Motors under Robert McCulloch.
Oh, and had you met him out there?
I knew him out there. He came out of the Army as a captain of the Air Force, mm-hmm. and Robert put him in there to be vice president in charge of everything going on.
Right.
And he decided to try to save Studebaker Corporation. And he would loan Sherwood Egbert to the Churchill.
McCulloch did.
McCulloch did. Churchill was the chairman of the board then.
Harold Churchill.
Harold Churchill. Mm-hmm. And Christopher, Mr. whatever, other name, I can't remember. And loaned him to him as president to go in there and save that business.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you're on leave of absence and go until it's fixed. Mm-hmm. And you can fix this thing. So he was down there for 8 days and was finally going to go to Germany to settle some of the details with Mercedes-Benz, because if you remember, they sold Mercedes cars for the first time in America through Studebaker dealers. They were joint dealerships, Mercedes and Studebaker. So he called me after he'd been back. He said, I'm going to Germany for 8 days. Come down on the 9th or whatever it is and meet with me. I want to talk to him. So I went down and had a day with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you're retained. Get going. Now, I want to see what you can do with the Hawk.
Did Mr. McCulloch put him on to you?
I knew him from out there.
Of course,
with
of
all
course.
That relationship out there, I'd known him very, very well.
Yeah.
So Sherwood called these people and said, look, you want to dump the Hawk car and build only this little Lark. And he said, this is ridiculous. The Hawk has a following. It's a luxury vehicle. We can't go out of the big car business and just make this little tin can thing, he called
right.
it, so on and so forth. The Lark, which was Harold Churchill's reduction of the thing in 58 to
right.
chop it off and make
yes.
it a little car again and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
The gas guzzlers and all this
mm-hmm.
was coming into vogue at the time.
Right.
So he said, I want you to do what you did with that Willys, Harold Willys. If you can make anything that good looking out of that,
mm-hmm.
my God, what could you do with this Hawk?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you notice, there's a Hawk over there. That
yes.
was the 64, the last one. I had three or four of those at one every year that we built them.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the last one, and I did, if you notice, the roof looks just like the, with the recessed rear window,
mm-hmm.
remember, cut
yeah.
in, and I took the roof from the Thunderbird, you might say,
mm-hmm.
that impression
right.
of the then Thunderbird,
right.
and I took the top molding across the fenders from the Lincoln Continental of that period,
uh-huh.
the four-door convertible and sedan with the suicide doors on
right.
it, had the molding down the thing.
Yes.
Cleaned out all the lowy junk that was all over the side of it, scallops in the side, and
mm-hmm.
old things from the older.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Redid, put the Mercedes grill on it, because we were in bed with Mercedes, and I wanted to carry the look of that famous heraldry of the Mercedes grill
right.
on the front, and changed the headlight bezels and the taillights, and completely disguised the car.
Mm-hmm.
And it went out there and it took off really for its time, and they only built like 12,000 a year or what it was, but it was the luxury car.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine it cost $3,800. I mean, a luxury car then. A Cadillac was only 42 or whatever then. So then we went to work on the lower line or the Lark line,
mm-hmm.
and finally did that over completely, and the prototypes are over there we built in Italy that were going to be. Are you going to go back in there to refresh any of that in
yes.
your mind?
Yes.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
in the morning or something?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Or are you going to?
Yes.
Those particular prototypes. Look
mm-hmm.
over those three, the station wagon, the sedan, and the Scepter Coupe,
mm-hmm.
which were to be three different model changes
mm-hmm.
with two sides each, gave us 3 times 2 is 6
mm-hmm.
cars for management to consider for 10 years thereafter.
Right.
All made out of those three,
mm-hmm.
which I built in Italy, and they cost $120,000 a piece, if you can imagine. They'd be $200,000
yes.
to even facelift something today.
What firm did that for you?
Sibona Bassano, a small firm in there operating in a small little old building with a yard out in the back with the clothes hanging and the chickens walking around back
yes.
and forth and ducks quacking and all this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we found these people and they were starving and we gave them the contract and they built them and they did a perfect job. If you look at them, interior, all the details. We did all the hardware, like
mm-hmm.
instrument panels and steering wheels over here and took it over there, but they put it all together. And they really are, for today, they could be acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
They could almost go with today's marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would stand up and hold pretty well. I had the rectilinear headlights in one.
Yes.
And that had never been heard. We took the Cibier lights out of France and put them in there, and they said, well, we can't use those because California won't pass the square light over the round and all that. But we pioneered all that in that and started the litigation that finally brought it to pass that we could have square lights here in America.
Can you spell the name of the Italian coach firm that you use?
Cibona. S-I-B-A-N-O, Cibona, B-A, Cibona, N-A-N-A, Cibona, Bassano, dash, B-A-S-S-O-N-A, I guess, Bassana,
Cibona
Bassana,
Turin. In Turin, yeah. How do you spell the name of the French headlight that you directed in your head?
Cibier. Cibier. They're on the market today. The
famous
riding lights, the red ones and the amber ones.
I've seen them. Yes, right,
spotlights and
right.
Fog lights and
Cibier.
Yeah, Cibier.
Yeah.
Cibie.
Cibier. Okay. Good. Mm-hmm. And what came of those prototypes? What happened?
Well, finally, when they went down the drain, Sherwood became terribly ill. He became ill, and it turned out to be cancer, and he finally died of it.
Yes.
And when he was so ill, I'm trying to think of the man that took over, it escapes me for the minute. He was second in command there. Mm-hmm. A lawyer, he took over, and I mean, they decided to liquidate. I mean, they couldn't fight the battle anymore, and it was downhill, and Sherwood died 2 years after that or something. One of my dearest friends.
Mm-hmm.
It was a terrible,
delightful
tragedy.
Man, from what all I've
but
heard.
We could have maybe made it if those new cars had gotten out. We'd warmed over the other cars as long as they could be warmed over. Just weren't. You couldn't stretch anything any further or redo anything anymore.
Now there was a parallel development, was there not, at this point with the Avanti?
Yes, Loewy was even involved in trying to design the new line of passenger cars,
yes,
which you found in that thing.
You and he were sort of competitors.
Competitors. We were in the main design studio. He had a separate room there that he'd come down there, and his men would work in where they did this Avanti thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very competitive, and he built two prototypes, I think are shown in that article, for the same purpose as the three we were going to build.
I see.
But management had pretty well decided on what we had being more practical.
Right.
He went into things that were like custom built cars that you couldn't, say, make 100,000 of these because it just was difficult to do. But then when Sherwood died, that ended that.
Mm-hmm.
And through the relationship there, I met all the people at Bud.
Oh.
And this is when two things happen. First of all, Sorensen re-enters the picture.
Does he? Really?
At about this time, he's now 70-some years old. He calls me from Florida and he says, I know that Studebaker Corporation probably is going down the drain. And Sherwood Egbert is ill and he's not going to make it. And you and I can fix this thing. He knew what we'd been doing all this time.
Mm-hmm.
Paralleled and watched everything go.
Right.
And he said, come down to Palm Beach at my home and spend some time here, and I'll tell you what I have in mind.
Uh-huh.
So I went down there, and he created mentally, jointly with our discussion, the idea of taking the Studebaker components, the engine, the suspension, and whatever driveline parts we could still use, but putting the engine transversely in the front and driving the front wheels. Now, my God, can you imagine what this, now sure it had been done in Europe vaguely by DKW and these Borg Wards and a bunch of these little things, and now it's just automatic and everything is that way. We had no way of knowing that then. But he said, this is the way to make this car. We brought it down to 104 inches or something like that, and have a symmetrical body using the symmetrical door concept that I have on that black sedan over there, where we use the front door from the front over on the rear diagonal, and likewise here to save half the tooling cost. Symmetrical hood and rear end deck unit and so forth. All the fenders were symmetrical and so forth. And we took all this, we made the renderings and all, and we went to meet them in South Bend and discuss this thing. No, first we brought him to Florida. We had a presentation down there, and then we went up to South Bend.
Did Charlie come with you?
Oh, yes.
He did?
Absolutely, sure.
Marvelous.
And he was still...
Very active.
Well, I mean, he could, you know, he was not that far. He was 70-something then, about like I am now. And I thought of him as a, you know, a father image almost, but here he was. And at this point, finally, they called us, and we went back up there for a meeting. They said, look, you know, now the money people are in it. The one, the Studebaker Corporation. You remember Egbert put an entire group of firms around the car company to bolster it during this time. An airline, a plastics company, a Franklin refrigerator company up in Minnesota, a Granatelli with the supercharger out in California. He bought that and brought it in. And Granatelli was running the car. He got the car to be the pace car for Indianapolis when he was running his big... whatever he called that thing, the four-wheel drive car he tried to run there, you know, and so on. So they felt that the automobile business had to go. The rest of it was profitable. And that was all sold to some other big outfit in the east somewhere that's still one of our big air conditioning companies. I can't think of the name of it right now. Bought up the residue of all this.
Carrier?
And the Carrier or something like that. And the airline was sold, and this, the plastics company, and that still is involved somehow. But
this was the board of directors who did this.
Yes, and it was managed by New York money people.
The banks,
so,
yeah.
The banks, yeah, might say. So the automobile people, the real car people were gone.
Oh.
No one cared anymore. There were no gasoline in the veins. It was just money and human beings, and shut her down and send them home. So
bottom line.
And so this is where Nate Altman then walks into the picture. Nate Altman was the largest Studebaker dealer right there in South Bend, next door to the factory. And he buys the Avanti remnants on the line, of which they'd only built 54 cars or something like that. And took it over and decided to try to make that run as the Excalibur type business from then on, and did perpetuate it right up until today. It's still struggling under this guy, Stephen Blake, or whatever his name
is. Coming to Detroit.
But we wonder if it'll ever make it. He's found a plant, supposedly, or something, but whether that'll...
The recent decision out of Detroit is that that he must assume a payback schedule, and they're giving him an extension.
Is that right?
The South Bend banks are giving him an extension.
Well, I read all that, but I'm wondering if that...
Well, we don't know.
Nothing. We haven't had any word since.
No.
The boys have been in touch with him right along, and he said, well, if he makes that, it'll be a miracle. But now, maybe we're all in the same boat. But that's where the story then moves us from there to American Motors.
Right.
And
now, Dick Teague... Charlie was disappointed, of course.
Oh, naturally, but in his position at that time. Then he married this lady from up here, and they finally lived happily ever after, and to whatever age that was, I'll never, 89 or something.
I think so, yes.
I think so, and he passed away down there in that beautiful Palm Beach place. But I've got pictures with him standing out there in the palms and so forth when we were there on this mission. I wish I was still there. It would be easier than now. I didn't have a walker then. I mean, I was mobile and long before the problems overtook me, which were... But that's all
in the future, in this sense.
Yes.
You're not too much daunted by the disappointment, but you're on to other things.
Yeah. But now we move from there to American Motors under Dick Teague. But I knew Bob Evans, Robert Evans, member of the Evans brothers in Detroit, the two brothers.
Right.
One ran the.
Was attempting to resuscitate American Motors.
Yes. In fact, Bob was the infusion of a good deal of money for stock. At that critical point.
Right.
And he was made chairman of the board. And he brought in, Chapin came
Roy
in.
Chapin, right.
Roy was his closest friend and had always been involved with the Nash in American Motor Hudson. His father was Hudson.
Right.
He built the Hudson Motor
Company. Right.
So he became the president, and it was actually, I met Dick. I'd known Dick before that, but it's when Chapin brought me over there. We met at the New York show, and he said, come over and see us, we've got to do something, and you're the one to do it, and so on. So he came over there and struck an arrangement, and I went into the thing with Dick, and of course he was the head of styling there, vice president in charge of that, had a pretty large department, 40 people against hundreds at General Himmelberg's and so forth.
He'd come over from Packard, but, I think, after the Packard
yes, mine. That's right. And and you remember Packard ended up at Studebaker, so
right.
This was interwoven. I mean, it's, right. It's all stapled together somehow.
Uh-huh.
And so we began to work on the first redesigns of the of what was to become the Hornet.
Oh, yes.
And we did everything here. Dick was doing the same over there. Mm-hmm. They were paralleling. And we brought a full-size clay model from here to Detroit
wow.
of the Hornet. You'll see all that development down there.
Mm-hmm.
And that went along through till that thing got off and running. And then we began on the Ambassador, which was still in to be considered then. But uh-huh. finally, that whole thing ran out of gas with money and so forth. But we got it up through a full-size fiberglass model
uh-huh.
on a turntable over there
uh-huh.
and showed it and all. And it was at that point in 72 or 3 or somewhere along there uh-huh. that they decided they'd have to give up the big car. Lunenburg was brought in.
Dick Lunenburg.
No, not Dick. Bill Lunenburg.
William.
Bill.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And I remember going at this point through the Bud connection. I was brought all the way to Volkswagen, and we did the 411 and 412 or what it was Volkswagen car that was the rear engine car to parallel the Beetle in this country for a few years. Do you remember the 411?
Oh yeah.
Sedan and so forth. Yeah. That's down there in those uh-huh. pictures.
Yes.
And I traveled to Wolfsburg and went through the unbelievable plant there. I had never seen such a thing in my life.
Mm.
And I remember I went through Lunenburg's family birthplace.
Uh-huh.
And I brought him back some souvenir from there, I don't know, some statuette or something from, it must have been Lunenburgville or something or whatever it was, family place. And so we built prototypes here, and through Bud we produced 40 prototypes from our clay model. Is mm-hmm. that getting toward the end?
No, you're fine.
Clay model and then the full-size cars, and they built 40 shells, and we trimmed them all, did all the trim work in at the Bud plant, interiors and all, and I took them over to the Wolfsburg plant
uh-huh.
and presented the first car to the management in what was called Valhalla, which was the huge oaken doors, that thick, in this massive German, typically furniture, heavy, you know, massive armchairs with big canisters with sand in them to put the cigars and all, with round tables for prints or magazines or mm-hmm. pictures or whatever, and then the car would be in the center on a turntable, and they'd walk through these massive doors and close them, and nobody ever got in there but the Valhalla group.
Mm-hmm.
was
mm-hmm.
a complete
sort of super group.
Mm-hmm. And so I met all the principals there and went through all that, and they finally built that car and put it on the market. So that was an interim in between there.
Now, what was the, was that the Valhalla? The
411.
The 411,
Volkswagen,
yeah.
Right. 411. Yeah. And it was produced for 6 years or seven mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah.
And then we go from American Motors for quite a while, and then...
What further work did you do for American Motors?
Well, all the way up through the AMX and the one before that, the coupe with Dick Javelin.
Did you work with Dick on those?
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure.
What was your input on those?
Well, we did a lot of the early creative renditions. We took over there maybe 150 projections of what that car could
really?
Look like and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And then the Gremlin
yes.
came out of one of those projections to really be either the Hornet or the Javelin. They took the front end from one and
uh-huh.
the chopped off rear end from one that we had as a sedan
uh-huh.
and put that together, and then I would run over there and collaborate with their group
uh-huh.
and we just generally worked together like
that. Marvelous.
But we just...
This is little known, your input into the AMX and the Javelin.
No, that's right. Well, that was just, you know, to have a measuring stick with an outside
mm-hmm.
feel of things, and we'd go over there and then we'd meld things together and
mm-hmm.
collaborate on it and make it into one idea, and then
mm-hmm.
we'd go over to look at theirs and comment, and it was just a consulting type of thing.
A collaborative consulting.
You could never say, David, that any one man ever designed a car,
right.
ever.
Mm-hmm.
It was always the work of a group of people.
Mm-hmm.
together and a thing comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
No, no, even Darren never designed a car except custom car, mm-hmm. one-off for mm-hmm. the Prince of Arabia or something
yeah.
like that, and he could hammer it out himself and do just what he wanted. But when you got into Detroit and mass production or Studebaker or anybody else, it never was one person.
True.
It had to be a collaborative effort on the part of many.
The AMX was in the fiberglass.
Wait a minute, excuse me, I gotta be sure this drive.
Did the AMX come in fiberglass, as I recall?
No, no, it's metal.
There was no fiberglass
in
any of those?
No. Okay. And everything was enough production so that, you know, fiberglass is, at that time, was not yet feasible for any large runs. I mean, you just can't, the molds and the
yeah.
process and even matched metal dies and all the rest of it. When we get into volume for Evinrude shrouds and so forth at 10,000 or 50,000 or whatever,
right.
even that takes multiple tooling and it's longer and time consuming, and but you get a finished part and all that and you can put the color in and so
yes.
forth. But you can't beat the sheet metal business,
mm-hmm.
except for Corvettes and low run
specialty
thing, and even that has now become a much different art than it was
yes.
back then.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So the AMX and the Javelin were all tooled and built in. They weren't huge quantities, but
no.
they were in, you know, 30 some thousand. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Teague has said to me that he regards those years as the Camelot years.
Yes, they were
AMC.
Yeah, that's right.
Doing something exciting with you on that.
Right, and. It was more the fun time and not
yeah.
the drudgery time
yes.
that's been since then. Just how I know that by the time he left and retired, which he certainly didn't have to do, except that he was at the age where I guess it was automatic or something,
yeah.
whatever.
Right, yeah.
He could be about only 65, I think, isn't he, or less?
A little less, I think, yeah.
A little less, 64. He may have gone a year earlier,
mm-hmm.
something
right.
like that. But he just, the French connection was not as much as pleasant as when he used to really run it. He spent a lot of time running back and forth to Europe, but
mm-hmm.
that just became drudgery by that
yeah.
time. It wasn't fun anymore.
Did you ever get to meet Charles Nash?
No, but I knew his granddaughter very well. She was the wife of George Weary and is today.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He married Jessie May Nash.
Uh-huh.
Grandma
yeah.
of Charles Nash. I just remember him once,
yeah.
way back, because
yeah.
it was a long, long time ago.
Well, the AMC consultantship came to an end,
and
what was your next move after that?
Well, now, in the automotive side of things, let me see now. I had that. Have you got that?
Yes.
Let me look on the list here. Did I give you the list of the cars? What did I do with that? That was in here, I thought. We're up through Studebaker, right?
Mm-hmm. Gone through Studebaker.
Yes.
AMC.
And AMC. We've covered the Sorensen Studebaker.
Right.
Now we move on into 65 of the. Well, in we began with the. Well, we covered the 68 Volkswagen 411
mm-hmm.
series with Bud,
mm-hmm.
then the AMC lines up through 70, and now comes Excalibur. Well, it started actually in 64, as you know, that was the first series,
but
21 years ago.
Do you want to go back to the early 50s, to the real start of the Excalibur?
Well, yes, which would be the race cars which were built.
Let's sort of develop the Excalibur, sort of
yes.
capture your career.
Yes, this was where... I was trying to interest Edgar Kaiser in building a low-priced American sports car.
This is in the 50s?
Yes. We're still in the Henry J. period,
right.
51.
Right.
We must be in 51, or 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said to him, I will build the prototypes if you will supply me with the chassis and engines from that were used in the Henry J.,
mm-hmm.
which were really Willie's engines that they bought from Willie's at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And let me take that car and I'm going to make a $2,000 American sports car. Oh, this, I mean, but go ahead, you show what we can do and so forth.
Who had designed the Henry J? Do you remember offhand?
Well, it was done in-house.
Yes.
With everybody walking around and Darren saying, that's ridiculous, why don't you put... The old man said, put the Cadillac tails on the fenders. But then I said, but Mr. Kaiser, you didn't put any lights in those tails.
Mm-hmm.
That was the famous taillight of the Cadillac. Right. And now just a little pillow thing sticking up off the fender isn't going to make any sense on the Henry J. Well, the taillights were inboard on the body. Just round stock items from Ajax Hardware Company or something. This was in the last minute depths of the Titanic end of all things.
Excuse me, let me stop there and change it.
Back at the time of the early situation with Kaiser and with Gettier, I said, I'm sure there's something in this sports car thing still that can be done. And our MGs and Jaguars and all the rest. I'd brought a Jaguar over, the XK120, the first one.
Yes.
I took it to Detroit. I let him drive it. The engineering people went crazy trying to look at this car and see all about it. So I was trying to get him imbued with the idea that a low-priced American sports car could be a viable market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Darren sliding door thing,
yes,
finally came out of this effort.
Ah.
I built the three cars here.
Mm-hmm.
And paid for them. He sent me all the innards and chassis and
mm-hmm.
running gear and engines and all that.
But built them here in your shop.
I built them here mm-hmm. privately
mm-hmm.
and raced them very successfully because they actually did very well. I think can I show you the racing record of those?
Not sure.
Now you won't be able to find that. That was with the... Well, anyhow. We raced them in 51, 52, 53, Sebring,
yeah,
and all the major races and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we could run away from a Jaguar XK120.
Mm-hmm.
What we did was to take this little Willys engine, the F-Head 6, Barney's last famous F-Head 6, that he had smoothed out and made a beautiful car out,
mm-hmm.
and moved it back 28 inches in the chassis,
mm-hmm.
which incidentally became the formula for the Ultimate. Excalibur,
yes,
moving the engine back and sitting almost in the back seat and so
mm-hmm.
on. And we raced these three cars around the country in all the sports car races in 51, 2, and 3,
mm-hmm.
and 4. And finally we ran out of car when the Mercedes Gullwing cars came over here and fell into our class, which was Class D or something
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that could go faster, there's no doubt about that. It was more horsepower, it was more everything,
mm-hmm.
and more aerodynamic, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But that gave the, you're going to say, how did you ever name it Excalibur?
Yes.
And I picked that name out of course, the King Arthur legend,
right,
of the famous sword, Excalibur,
right, mm-hmm.
which meant in the Gaelic, invincible.
Ah.
And we became relatively invincible with the car. So that name I owned and copywritten,
right,
and so forth, and used it on everything thereafter. And it was from that that the interest on the part of the boys came to producing something in this area. And it was when I was still dealing with the Studebaker Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Egbert is very ill, but management has said, well, we'll let you produce this dream car. I said, send me top Lark chassis at that time was the Daytona.
Yes.
Or Daytona Coupe and so forth.
Right.
Send me the Daytona chassis and engine, and with this top management then, the Byers-Burlingame.
Byers-Burlingame.
B-Y-E-R-S. He was the man with the little black bag that had the money.
Oh, yes.
Of the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent me this chassis. He said, what are you going to do with this? And I said, well, I had to think of something. I said, I'm going to build a car for the New York show. Well, what kind of a car? We can't build any. I mean, this is almost, you know. I said, but we're stuck with the show. We've spent $87,000 or whatever it is for the space. We have to go there and stand there like Pagliacci and at least do something to,
sure,
to keep this thing, our spirits up.
Yeah.
And I said, I want to build this car that will be a contemporary classic.
Mm-hmm.
I created the term.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, my God, what is a contemporary classic? I said, Pyers, it's a new old car. I didn't know how else to explain it.
Right.
So that term has become the mantle for all of these attempts at a contemporary classic.
Mm-hmm.
And so we built the car, the only one ever built with a Studebaker engine.
Uh-huh.
And that's number one over there in the show, in the museum.
That's marvelous.
With the engine moved back, the same formula I used for the race car,
mm-hmm.
and the big Studebaker 289 mm-hmm. engine with a McCulloch blower on it, supercharger, which they had bought when it was Paxton, and put it in there, so you see how it's all intertwined.
Is McCulloch still alive at this point?
No, he's passed.
I mean, in the time of number two?
Yeah, no, he may have been gone by then, I'm not sure. I can't remember I went out there with Granatelli to the funeral and all, that was somewhere in the 60s.
Yeah. So in the 50s he's still
around, but I think this was already 64 or something.
Oh, I see.
So the Series 1 came out in 64 and then was built for 5 years in the 70s, Series 2 and Series 3, Series 4, and now Series 5. So
now you shouldn't gloss over them too quickly. Tell us about
how they changed. Well, David took over then as president of the company and chief designer of the manufacturing. And
the president of Brookstein Associates the Excalibur company?
Yeah, that was their company right from the beginning.
Was it?
I only invested money for them at the beginning.
David and
some $10,000 or something to start the company.
I see.
And they took it from there and made it into a $15 million.
Took it from number one.
Yes, that's right. Uh-huh. Took that prototype. We went to the New York show, and the people were intrigued with this thing.
Yes.
They wanted to buy them. My goodness. People came on the stand. Our famous friend that ran at Le Mans that has the music, Briggs Cunningham,
mm-hmm.
ordered one and so on and so forth. So we came back with six or eight orders, and they mm-hmm. said, we're going to go in business and build these cars. And I mean, I thought, oh, this. And they started out here in the model shop area of the museum building.
David and William?
And William and a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And they built the prototype car together. And that was handmade in aluminum and went to the New York show and then came back. Then we decided that fiberglass was the way to go. And that's how we got into that and built the rest of the business. They built about 34 cars out here and then went downtown.
Uh-huh.
First one plant and then another and then a third.
Now David William had engineering background.
Oh yes, he came out of engineering college.
Uh-huh.
And David also was in engineering. William started in engineering, then went into finance.
I see.
With another Spencerian University here into
mm-hmm.
money matters. So
right.
Not knowing that this was what he was going to do,
uh-huh.
but somehow they meshed perfectly.
And
Dave was the engineer,
yes.
and he was the salesman and so forth, and that's how they've continued everything.
And you contributed the design expertise.
Well, just... David carried on from there on, and I'd go down there and look at the prototype of
mm-hmm.
Series 2 and
right.
made little suggestions.
Yeah.
I probably was involved in Series 1 totally and Series 2 a little bit, and 3, I just was a consultant, and 4, and so on.
You haven't told us, Mr. Stevens, the genesis for the Excalibur design. Can you
it's a couple
of decades ago.
Yeah, if we go back to 64. And one of my most favorite cars was the Mercedes SSK.
When you were a youngster?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always loved it. And finally, in the museum, I acquired an SS-180 Phaeton, which incidentally was owned by Caracciola. It was the car they gave him after he won the Tourist Trophy and several other major races as a gift. And it was his personal car.
Uh-huh.
And that went to the jazz singer. In the movies.
Al Jolson?
Al Jolson.
Right.
And I bought it from his estate. He had three Mercedes, this SS Phaeton and a limousine and a coupe or something.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so I bought that, brought it away all the way from California and felt that somehow if someone could design and build a replica of this car, then
mm-hmm.
there could be a business for those who could not find one of the few that were left in the world. They only built a few hundred to start with, ever,
mm-hmm.
in the whole history of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some 15 of those are extant.
Huh.
And to restore one of those, and I said back in those days it cost $60,000 to restore it, today it would be $600,000 to do it right, you know, and so forth. So this was the way to buy a contemporary classic for a reasonable amount of money and have
mm-hmm.
a very modern thing. In fact, we called it jokingly a two-way classic. You could turn the key, push the button, and you could go and come back again. That the restored classics were one-way classics. You could just go to the meet and probably never get them back.
Right.
So that turned out to be relatively true. So that brings us up to the present car, which then made its major change in 80 into the complete convertible with a motion top, a moving mechanized top, and thick doors and glass windows and electric windows and all the refinements that brought it up to about the 540K lineage, which is that one that you see in that painting, the yellow.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Like that car. That's a replica of that car.
Uh-huh.
And,
but initially you tried to almost exactly emulate
The SS.
The SS.
SSK. And other than being 18-inch wheels instead of 26-inch wheels and so forth, it was just a lowered version of that.
Right.
But if you lay the profile of that car, I thought there was a picture of it up here, down below there.
Yeah.
Profile of that car onto the SSK, other than it being that much higher, it would be a replica of that.
And in so doing, you you brought...
We created an industry.
That's right. But you also brought, that's much more important than what I'm going to say, but you created a almost exact replica car, and you brought racing and sport enthusiasts back into the late 20s and early 30s.
Yeah, right, which was the romantic part of
And in so doing, I think you created a whole new generation of sports cars enthusiasts who insisted on the original. Something close to the original.
That's right. And of course, at first, the dyed-in-the-wool purist looked upon this as a fraud and so forth, that it couldn't be, it wasn't the real thing and all that. But the people we were after were the other ones who couldn't ever aspire to the real thing and didn't care whether it was Caracciola's car or Neubauer's or anybody else. They would just take this, which they could buy and run it on the street as a regular car and then run it fast when they wanted to. So it had its life that way.
It certainly did. And forgive me, one more question. In doing that, you you really pretty much created the replica car.
Oh, absolutely. There was the next vehicle to be made was this 8/10 cord, which came within the same year that we produced it by this Glen Prey. But that was the Corvair with this fiberglass body on it or whatever. And that never really, I don't think he made 25 cars or whatever. But, and then there have been many, many things come and go since then, at least 100 makes, I suppose, here and there, all over California and everywhere. But this really was the birth of it and lasted the longest, let's say.
It has,
So then, from there on, the industrial design business carried on in the overall of all products that we've talked about today, and continues that way today. And Kip was made president in 79.
That's your youngest son.
The youngest son.
Had he come through up through the engineering
route? Yeah, he went actually to Syracuse University and studied industrial design, which was the very earliest course ever and the best one. When we went around the country looking for a place for him to go, and he chose to study to be an industrial designer, and the others have made their mark and so forth. My daughter was in the airline field and so on, as a in the merchandising flying. And so he went there and graduated from there, and then he went immediately to Dick Teague, who hired him right out of college, and put him into American Motor Styling Division. He spent a year and a half or so there.
What is Kip's first name?
It's really Kip. It's K-I-P-P.
Is it really?
Yes. It was my nickname, but we made it a serious name for him.
Was that your childhood nickname?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I've always been known as that as a nickname, but K-I-P, one
name. Right, as you gave it to me.
So that was to make it very formal, but the second field. So then in this business now, he has been very prominent.
The Brooks and Stevens Associates.
Brooks Stevens Design Associates, and has been president since 79, I think it is, or 78. That's when I had the heart business with bypasses and all the rest of it, and problems from then on. So he's done a marvelous job, which you'll read about in that little brochure I gave you, article. And there we created the Globe Union cars, which are the electric cars, battery-powered. You probably saw them on the wall out here, the yellow sedan with the six wheels on it.
Can you develop that a bit? Tell us a bit about that.
Oh, yes. This was where Fred Stratton, who was the son, and 5 days younger or older than David, I'm not sure, we were close, the mother and the father, who's since passed on, unfortunately, but had these children at the same time, lived next door and all this sort of thing. The Strattons were a famous family here in the grain business, H.M. Stratton, Stratton Grain Company, and also co-partner with Stephen Briggs, who created Briggs and Stratton. That's where that comes from. Yes. And they, in 1910, built a Briggs and Stratton automobile, made six of them by hand, and then decided not to go into the budding business. But therefore, there has been a lineage even of that all the way from there. Mm-hmm. So young Fred, who heads, that's the son now of my contemporary friend, who's passed on, and Kip are the same age. And I had been working for Briggs and Stratton all this time.
Of course, yes.
So he took over immediately with him, and today they're in the engine business and all the offshoots of Briggs and Stratton. And when it came time to explore this hybrid electric, where Fred saw the chance for battery electric power cars having some possible hope, but they, it wasn't too great, but there was some. Mm-hmm. If you could find a way to prolong the drive from 52 miles to 500 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So by coupling the twin, opposed twin, four-cycle engine in series with an electric motor, a GE or something or other, through a, I think it's a Ford transmission or from the Comet or one of those famous cars, a four-speed or something, and running the six wheels, a six-by-six concept in the chassis to carry the battery weight, which is fantastic. That's a huge complement of batteries on top of that thing. And to make this into a special car, which he was then going to show around the country, plugging, of course, his 20 horsepower new twin engine, which we had done the styling of. And so we built the car, built it here, complete from scratch. Chassis, driveline, fiberglass body, made our own molds, clay model first, took the, you'll see in the brochure, I think it may show some pictures of that. The one, the black one in there, I think it's in there. Yeah, here. So here's the clay model.
Ah, yes.
The size there. And finally, there's the car.
Oh, marvelous.
And if you look at that carefully, if you forget the six-wheel concept, that's like every coupe today, every one of the new Dodges and all the rest of them.
Why the six-wheel concept? How does that
to carry the batteries.
Of course. You need a tremendous
weight,
load.
Tremendous weight. There. Now, that car would go as high as 75 miles an hour. It would, no electric car had ever been over 50, maybe. And instead of travel period of 50 miles or something, and then everything's gone and you have to recharge, stop someplace and say, can I borrow your light plug and run up the bill for while I eat lunch or something. He was not doing a job of trying to run a gasoline engine into a generator to recharge the batteries, but giving this power assist that when the car got up to speed, it would coast and then run on the gas engine and back off the electricity and all that. That extended the mileage way up. Well, no, it didn't recharge. It just let it live longer.
I see.
So you got much greater mileage out of it. And then recharged overnight.
Was this young Fred's conception?
Yes.
It was marvelous.
Well, through a firm in Canada, we found something about a van up there that they bought the engines for and were going to do something like this. So we did this to parallel it and really make it come alive. So then we got back into the last one on here, really, is the AMC, the new Jeep and Cherokee Wagoneers.
Tell us about how that developed.
Well, we just were called back by Dick Teague to work on the new line in 1980, and that's finally come to pass, and a viable vehicle in 83, I think.
Yes.
Now it is going very well, even at a tremendously high price. That current smaller station wagon lives beside the wagon here of 1960, which was our redesign of 1946. So we've been involved in every segment of that Jeep heritage, and those station wagons are still, the large American Motors version of today is just like we did it in '60 with facelifts, but the basic tooling is still there. And then we patterned the little one with the vertical. It still has the grill slots of the very first 46 Jeep grill as its look or its recognition.
Recognition.
If you look at a GM, what is the name of the, what do they call their short truck type thing like that, a station wagon thing. They've got names for them, I can't remember.
Right.
But they don't have the recognition value that this has. Mm-hmm. So that, I guess, is the story, automotively speaking, right up to the minute.
Were you involved in any way in the Comanche?
Yes, that's the present line.
Yeah, right.
The Cherokee, Comanche. The Comanche is the truck
version
of that. It's just the short cab again, the very thing you saw here.
Is it the same as the big one? The big.
Well, it's the small one, but I showed you that photograph.
Yeah,
here.
There it is, yeah.
In other words, that's the way it was done then,
right.
And that's the way it's done now.
Right.
They just used the front door and a short roof, and then a new box on the back, which is out to absorb the fender.
Uh-huh.
Of the present, right.
Well, that's an incredible story that you've been involved with so many things, but...
I don't want you to lose this one.
Thank you.
I'm going to hand it back to you.
Thank you. The AMC connection, I think, is not very well known, that you've been involved in every post-war...
As a consultant, You've got to realize, again, that no one man ever does anything.
Right, yeah.
And so I was only an adjunct to that department, this firm was.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But it was selected from we probably produced 12 or 15 prototype renderings and designs for this last new wagon, small wagon. And it was built virtually like that.
Yes.
That comes the closest to anything.
The relationship with Richard Teague has been very, very...
Oh, we were dearest of friends.
Yes. Looking back on your career, I wanted to ask you about something you didn't talk too much about, the Valkyrie.
Oh, De Valkyrie.
De Valkyrie. Yeah, Valkyrie. Yes, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yes, that was designed for a syndicate in Cleveland at the time. That's, again, 52 or 3 or something like that. What's the date by that? That was in the Paris show.
Right.
It was in the Paris show.
Right.
And I took a Cadillac chassis and built that body at Spohn. It was for a group in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And we showed it in Paris and then built about 6 of them thereafter to order.
And you kept one of the original ones.
That was built for Alice at the time.
Or for your wife.
She drove it until it was time to retire. Mm-hmm. We got into Studebakers and so forth thereafter.
I wanted to ask you also a little bit about the Scimitar, how that came about.
Well, that's Olin Aluminum Corporation.
Oh, is it?
And I was very close to Tom Nichols, who was chairman of the board of Olin Aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to show to the American automobile industry that aluminum might still be a viable material for automotive industry at the time.
Sure.
Steel was in...
It was 56.
Difficult to get and so on. Mm-hmm. And that we produced those three cars. There were three of them built. Hardtop coupe, which we have here, a sliding roof station wagon, which is where the sliding roof concept for Studebaker came from as an invention.
Mm-hmm.
The sliding roof was so that you could slide it in there and put a refrigerator in the back to take it home, or a giraffe, or a potted palm, or whatever, and it became the first sit in the back seat and look outside and so forth.
Right.
And then the other was the convertible town car, which was a four-door with a sliding front roof that slid into the rear roof, and then both roofs were swallowed by the rear deck, making an open convertible sedan, or a closed formal town car, or an owner-driven full sedan, all in one.
These were made for?
For Olin Aluminum.
For Olin Aluminum.
And that everything you see on that car over there that's in the silver is aluminum.
Aluminum.
And the rest is sheet metal painted black. The bumpers are aluminum, the grill is aluminum, the side panels where it gets all the salt and snow and slush and whatnot are aluminum and so on.
Incredible. You mentioned that you've done an early Alfa Romeo.
The 1800 Sprint.
Sprint series. How did that come about?
Well, I went to Europe in 50 to the Paris show at the request of a man I knew here, and again at McCulloch Motors, who went over there to help in the resurgence of Italy's automotive industry as a consultant to Alfa Romeo. And he said, you've got to stop building handmade cars for convertibles for Rita Hayworth, and there isn't after you've gone around Hollywood once, you're through. And the plant was in a shambles, and they were going to come back. And they came back with this relatively ordinary, but a copy, literally, of the Kaiser sedan, you might say, the full length fender panels in the doors and so on, called the 1800 sedan. Mm-hmm. And then we did the more advanced 1800 Sprint Coupe, which was a two-door version of that and a better looking car. I had an Alpha, which is over there. It's a 1950, which I got at the company at that time and brought it over here and drove it as a personal car.
But this particular one is not not extant.
Well, they built them in production, what they called production at the time.
I see. Yeah.
I mean, it was hundreds or a few thousand or something. But it went for several years. But it was a nice little 1800cc type car. Mm-hmm.
I don't think you mentioned the Monart Mercury in 1940. Oh,
well, yes, you'll see that in the Exhibit 2. This is when the cars were frozen by the government. Uh-huh. Dealer cars in stock for the war effort. There was no more metal to make them and so on and so forth. So the cars were stuck into a government pool and they were going to be issued out then, and you were allowed to buy a car if you worked for a war-supported industry or something, you know, that type of thing.
Yes.
Otherwise, you couldn't buy a new car. Well, this man was the largest dealer in the Midwest of Lincoln Mercury.
Ah.
And he took the Mercury sedans, and we had two-door sedans, which we cut up in four-door sedans, took the rear off of them, and added a wooden kit of machined, mass-produced wood parts, jointer work, with a streamlined rear end, which came off of a Packard that I had designed, one of, for Mr. H.M. Stratton, the grandfather of this present boy, out of a Packard 120 for his son.
Mm-hmm.
And this, these then pushed those cars up from 3 to 6 to 9 passenger, you know, the carpool system, take the people to work, all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they converted, through the government, thousands of with those kits. That put all the woodworking people to work on war work and took the pool of cars and jacked them up one third in capacity, you might say, or ability to service the public.
And you turned it into the first 9 passenger station?
Yes, that's right.
Incredible.
And had the rear facing seat in that, and like the, and they also used ambulances.
As an ambulance?
Ambulance.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It was anything to increase the mobility and capacity of the war. Born in
industry. You mentioned the, I'm looking here at something that catches my eye, the in the 59 Willys series you have a Sportif.
Oh, this was a small civilianized version of even the Army Jeep.
Oh, was it?
Yes, and they built prototypes of those. And they were made in limited volume. It was the forerunner of the Jeepster.
Was it?
It was a drop door, little two-seater with another seat in the back, and became what the CJ5 is today.
Really?
That type of a...
Of course, yes.
But now they left the... Instead of the drop door and having a door, you still walked over the side of a regular CJ5.
Which is really
the kids' car of today. That would have been the the thought of that.
The thought of it, right, the vision. What is that? What is that? Willys, 1961 Willys IVI. That you list?
This was one of the executives at Kaiser Willys. Then we took this idea of a chassis with a mid-engine, four-wheel drive, with a very structural, straightforward body with no draw dies, no compound curves, nothing, just bent curved roof and pillars and. And it's still in metal now, not fiberglass or anything like that. And took it to Europe. This was for the underdeveloped countries right after the war. And it was finally manufactured in Spain by Seat. And if you remember them as a supplier there. And this was to use the unskilled labor to put these things together and put them to work to give them a lifestyle. And it was a truck with a base thing, front cab over engine type truck with a bed with sides that lifted up and down and so forth, or a station wagon version which could become a 9 passenger and derivatives like that. So you can make it all out of one. You'll see that down there.
How did that go? Was it?
It went for a while. It fulfilled its mission of trying to put the Africans to work or whatever they were at that time, the Spaniards and so forth.
The Electro Winds must have been early.
That was an early projection of what could be done with a small 3-passenger thing with a revolving fan in the roof that ran as you drove this little vehicle, a two-place thing, with its batteries and started to lose power, all the time you were driving it forward, it was cycling a fan within that upper roof system, mm-hmm. like a ventilating fan with multiple blades or like a turbine mm-hmm. blower, mm-hmm. and that was regenerating down through a generating system to boost it back up. And you maybe could pick up 15% to 20% of what it, and put back. Uh-huh. Now, when you came to a stop and idled, why the prevailing wind would still run the fan, and you were trickling something. It was a trickle charge.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to interest anyone in that? That remained a prototype.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you see yourself as a visionary? I certainly do. In this industrial design.
Yes, I suppose so. I was always looking toward something different, something new, something, and then they'd become innovative.
Right.
But there was always seemed to be a need, and we'd try to solve it and then make it into something.
Well, you've done a magnificent job. Your career is incredible.
Well, it's been an interesting and very satisfying situation.
Well, you obviously are going on. I hope to do other visions.
Well, I don't know how long it can go.
Well, perhaps tomorrow we can talk about the selected segments of your career.
When you have